Hi, my name is Chip Spear, and you're listening to Earth Plus 30. Welcome. One of my big concerns about the future has to do with data privacy. I thought that it would make a great topic for conversation for a podcast. In today's internet world, we provide so much information to online entities, whether they be corporations or nonprofit organizations or various government entities. I'm thinking national, state, local, or county governments. Where is all this information going and who's controlling it? What type of security is there? And why should I trust these corporations? What can I do? Maybe there are huge corporations like Google and Facebook and Apple. How can I know that they're actually looking out for my interest with regard to my data? I've had a number of conversations with friends, acquaintances, and experts, but one of the most interesting I had was with a good friend of mine by the name of Michael Moynihan, who has experience in both the corporate world and in government. I thought he'd make a great guest, and I want to introduce you to Michael. Michael, thank you very much for joining me today. I'm really excited about this conversation. I want to introduce my listeners to Michael Moynihan. Michael is another one of these very interesting people who live in my town. I know him through my girlfriend, who is like best friends with his wife. And we have gotten together on a number of occasions for dinner and had some very interesting conversations. And the reason that I asked him on today was started when he told me about an application that he had developed called Boonon, which helps people make better decisions with what they are trying to do with their life. And it raised some questions to me because of my concerns about security and privacy to talk to him in a little bit more detail about how he has dealt with this and about his background. Because Michael has a very interesting background in both government and in corporate world. And I thought that he would make a great guest. So, Michael.
Well, Chip, thank you. It's great to be on here. And I am the CEO of a company that's developed an app that's available now on the App Store called Boonon. And it is an app that has agent, a digital assistant by the name of Max, who helps you make better decisions, who you can talk to and helps you make better decisions about running your life. And so it's kind of a productivity app powered by artificial intelligence with digital agent by the name of Max.
So tell me a little bit about that. How did that come about? Why did you see an opportunity here? And when you say it gives me like advice on how to do things better, what exactly does that mean?
Well, I have always been interested in productivity. And it's something that from the very beginning of computing, productivity was really essential to the early PCs. Programs like VisiCalc and Lotus were kind of the killer apps for PCs. Productivity was also very important in the early digital organizers like the Palm Pilot and the Trio and so forth. And interestingly enough, when it entered the phone era, which was in the aughts around 2006, 2007 with the iPhone, I think people expected productivity to be an important piece, but it kind of got pushed a little bit to the side by the entertainment value of the phone, which is really obviously taken off like crazy. But I have been, in my personal life, was always very focused on productivity. So over the years, I've used different systems in keeping track of things on programs that I wrote, real simple programs. But a few years ago, I thought it would be a great thing to take advantage of the new technology of artificial intelligence and try to take the productivity space into the next kind of generation and build an app that not only kind of keeps track of what you're doing, but tries to recommend what you should be doing next and get you to use your time more effectively. So that's kind of the origins, from my point of view, of this this application.
Yeah. So tell me how you do that. How does the application work?
Well, all productivity applications have to sort of learn about the person that they're helping to be more productive. So first of all, it keeps track of everything. And other applications do that as well. But it keeps track of your contacts. It keeps track of your notes. There's a place to enter notes. It connects notes to people and to tasks. And It keeps track of facts, little FAQs, if you will, that little pieces of information that you might need, lists, all kinds of things that may be of interest to you. So number one, it has to have memory, and it has to know about, understand your life, and so it has to keep track of things in your life. But where the AI kicks in is it then takes this information and understands like who's important in your life, which contacts are really most important to you. And it tries to make recommendations about what you should be doing next using a mixture of what it knows about you as well as what it knows about the world. And where the magic happens, where you get the flywheel effect, is that as more people are using the app, there's more data, and you can begin to, you know, sort of behind the scenes benefit from the information that other people are providing, although obviously that's totally anonymized, so you don't see somebody else's information unless they choose to make it public. But behind the scenes, that provides data that can be then crunched using these wonderful new machine learning technologies and so forth to, you know, basically elevate and provide notifications and so forth about what you should be spending your time doing as opposed to what you may be doing.
So it's something like a Waze type of program in a way. It's crowdsourcing a lot of different data and helping you get to where you want to go in a way?
One of the ways we think of it, it's a nav for your life as opposed from getting to point A to point B on the map. It's from point A to point B in your life. And this is not a trivial or easy problem to solve. But what we're really anticipating is that computers have been so valuable in so many other parts of life that it's only a matter of time until the computer isn't just something that you record information on. It's something that's always there kind of giving you little ideas and basically supporting you as you, you know, live your life. And, you know, it already is that in the sense that, you know, you can go online and check a piece of information. But rather than you having to go online and then it passively reacts and gives you the information, we think there's greater value if the computer figures out what information you need or what people you need to reach out to. And so basically, and then provides that information to you. So it does some of the thinking for you. And of course, you have the final decision, but it makes this available to you in order to help you use your time more effectively.
So it's sort of like a little pal you're carrying around and saying, ding, ding, you should be doing this instead of that. And I think you should go and call so-and-so if you're in this particular area. Or
if people are operating in our society at certain, you know, very high levels of institutions, for example, they have what's called a beyond administrative assistant. They have an aide de camp or, you know, people basically providing them with ideas at all times. Mm-hmm. And they make the final decision. But all these people are supporting them. And of course, administrative assistants are rarer and rarer these days. But that only means that the computers are doing more. And we think that our assistant, Max, can basically give you better and better information to help you make better and better decisions.
So give me some examples of how this kind of works. You know, I put in a list, my shopping list. I put in contacts. I'm working on some project, or let's say I'm trying to start a new business of one sort or another, and I put down lists, and let's say it's only part-time.
Sure.
You know, what's it going to tell me, or how's that going to happen?
We start with certain things that are kind of passively learned about you, and we start with things that you may not think about, but that we can reasonably assume to be true. For example, most people are going to have breakfast, they're going to have lunch, they're going to have dinner, and their schedule is going to be built, subdivided into a morning and an afternoon and an evening. So we try to make notifications and recommendations that are appropriate to the time. We use the calendar as well. For example, mm-hmm. certain days of the year are holidays, certain days of the year are tax days, you know, when taxes are due. So we try to fit that information into algorithms that makes recommendations. Then we know that if you are reaching out to a certain person or checking a certain contact frequently, that contact is probably somebody that you're interacting with a lot, you know, at a given point of time. So when you enter tasks or whatever, we try to match those tasks with people. So, you know, whereas your traditional task manager simply as you write down like a to-do list, if you will. A modern to-do list, or you know, sort of a better to-do list, is one that links those tasks with the people that are part of those tasks, and links the task with lists that might be relative, and elevates that information, kind of like you can do in your own memory or in your own mm-hmm. mind. You might think, oh, I'm going shopping. Where's my shopping list? But wouldn't it be nice, you know, since we don't have perfect memories, if the computer could say, okay, you're going shopping. As a matter of fact, the store is 2.2 miles away. Here's the route to the store, and here's your list, and elevates all that information to you at the same time. Some technologies that are kind of broadly speaking in this category are already used in specialized applications. So for example, a pilot has access in a modern military aircraft has accessible all kinds of information that is basically being conveyed to them on a sort of time-sensitive basis that will help them doing what they want to do. There's no reason that, you know, our computers shouldn't be able to similarly be supporting us. It's not going to be kind of life and death as it is for a pilot, but they can be providing us with useful information that helps us basically just go about our day and make better decisions.
A lot of people probably aren't familiar with that, including myself. So do you know a little bit more about what kind of information is provided to a pilot at a particular point in time? Or like what kind of stuff would that be?
In a combat situation, there's going to be, you know, in addition to the actual vision that the pilot might have, there's going to be a lot of computer sort of simulations in their field of vision that show mm-hmm. things that might not be available in vision. There'll be things like little numbers that signify the altitude of the aircraft.
Oh.
If the aircraft's engaged in some kind of combat, there'll be information relative to that. So I'm just using this as a metaphor because obviously we're not doing those precise types of things. But the people that develop those systems for the military are thinking, what information is critical to the pilot at this point in time, given what we know about the theater, if you will, in which the mm-hmm. pilot is operating? So on a much more kind of prosaic level, but nonetheless something that is important to people, people need certain information at certain times. And if you are a top executive of a large company, there's probably going to be somebody whispering in your ear, this is what you need to do next, providing you with information. But most of us don't have that person following us around. So it'd be nice if we have an assistant that can kind of fulfill that role. So that's kind of what we're going, and we're getting better and better at it every day. We can still, I mean, there's still a long way to go, but mm-hmm. it's an exciting time.
I know you haven't had this application out for very long, but based on how long it's been out, are you getting kind of reports and trends and seeing things on that are either you find interesting or that you want to tweak on sort of a macro level?
Yeah, I mean, that is our focus. And I should say that this product, although it is live in the App Store, has not been advertised, and it's kind of in a, I won't say a stealth mode, but it's in a point at which we're trying to really fine tune it and get it right mm-hmm. before we publicize it. But we're getting a lot of people that are downloading it and using it, and we're studying that data and trying to use it to make the product better and better, to the point where when we really think that, I think the goal in achieving what they call product market fit is you want to create something that people find indispensable and they just love.
Right.
And
mm-hmm.
when we're really confident we're there, that's when we'll begin, you know,
really pushing,
with publicity and so forth.
So that leads me to one of my concerns, as well as just the interest of, gee, I want to be more productive in what I do. But on the flip side, you're getting an awful lot of data from me as a user, right? I sign up and you have access to all of my tasks, my calendar, where I am, who I'm with, what my concerns are, my targets, what I've done or haven't done. And based on a period of time, you get an awful lot of personal information from me. So
yeah, and you know, it's almost kind of, when you think of it, it is kind of awesome or awe-inspiring to see that data pouring through. And I would say that Google, in their headquarters in Mountain View, that when you walked in, they have a thing where you can see the searches that are going on all over the world live.
Right.
And you know, they censor them slightly, but it is kind of amazing to sort of see that hive of, if you will, that's of intelligent activity taking place. Any internet company that has large numbers of customers, as a matter of fact, even any bricks and mortars company is constantly collecting a lot of data. And it's important that the data be safeguarded. It's so much data that it really, just to sort of put you at ease a little bit, there's just too much data to really pay attention to one particular person unless you were really interested in that particular person. And that's why the data is encrypted and anonymized on servers. But so, and the individual data doesn't really have very much, the individual data about one person doesn't have that much value. But when you aggregate it across large numbers of people, you can run machine learning algorithms and so forth and see how different people respond to different things. And that's where it gets, you know, you sort of get that flywheel effect that I mentioned earlier.
Right.
So all the companies have to deal with it. I think the probably from the, and privacy is something that I've been very interested in for many years. The thing that really, I think, provides the greatest security is if you are not selling the data to advertisers. So, for example, right. Apple is much more, you know, pro-privacy, I think, than because they make their money on their phones and on the hardware right. for the most part, than companies that are selling ads. And those companies that are selling ads have to be very careful because, on the one hand, they want to offer their advertisers this incredibly detailed data that lets them reach the people that are most likely to buy their product. But they want to do that in a way that doesn't compromise the privacy of their users.
Might question that and say, how do I know that's actually true? Why should I trust the corporation to protect my data?
Well, I think when I say they're doing a balancing act, obviously, if their privacy is lost too many times, it's going to hurt their business. So whatever their morals are, if they have too many data breaches or people get upset about privacy breaches, it will ultimately affect their business. So you see some of these large companies that have been collecting data have announced that they're going to do more on the privacy front because of some of these events that have occurred. In our case, we plan to monetize our service through subscriptions for power users using a freemium model. So we don't plan to sell it to advertisers. We hope that that will give our users a greater level of comfort that their data is safe.
So explain what that is.
Well, the freemium model is pretty well established. There's a free tier. People get to use it and try it out and see if they like it. And if they like it, they make a more of an investment in the product and they engage with it. And at some point, they may think, wow, I'm getting some value out of this and want to use it more. And you basically say, well, okay, at this point, you know, you're really using it a lot. We're going to have to start charging you per month. And if they see the value, then it's good for both parties. And that's been a pretty effective model for a number of different companies.
I know you've had a long background of being involved in computers and also in privacy-related issues. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that background?
Oh, sure. I worked in the Clinton administration on internet issues. And although privacy was an issue long before the internet kind of revived attention to it. There was a famous Privacy Act that was passed in 1974 to protect things like tax returns and Social Security information. You know, you don't think about it too much, but when you get your paycheck every week or 2 weeks or month, that data is actually sent to the government because of the taxes that are withheld. Mm-hmm. And I think we have a pretty high level of confidence that that data will not be misused. It would be extremely hard for somebody to get your salary using, you know, although that data is known to both state, local, and federal government. And tax data is also, you know, held by the IRS, and you almost never hear of an instance of that being compromised. So there was a lot of attention to privacy prior to the internet. But the internet policy that I worked on kind of like revived the tension in it. And what we thought at the time was that rather than the government being too prescriptive on privacy, it was better because the technology was moving so rapidly to provide market-based solutions. Now, in the last probably 5 or 6 years, and I should say, there was actually a long period after the introduction of smartphones and social media in the mid-noughts, where people were almost oblivious to privacy. The pendulum swung so far to the side of, you can have all my data, I don't care, I'm living a totally transparent life. That was in some ways surprising given attention to privacy prior to that. But I think it reached a point in the last 4 or 5 years where people realized that a lot of their data was being collected, not just by their friends who they were sharing it with on social media, social networks, and so forth, but by people that were using it in ways that they weren't comfortable with. And that has provoked this new attention to privacy. And frankly, not that much has happened since this new attention to privacy has emerged in the last 5 or 6 years. No laws have been passed. But companies have to be much more aware of it. Apple has made a major commitment to privacy. They keep a lot of the data as much as they can on the physical device, encrypted, as opposed to sending it over servers. So
that data is staying on my phone.
Certain things stay on your phone, like, for example, face recognition and that sort of thing. There are new chips out that do the machine learning that is used in a lot of increasingly used on the phone, as opposed to sending it back over the network where it would be, you know, sort of more widely available. So there's certainly a desire to increase privacy. On the other hand, since your data is worth money, the free model is usually going to involve taking your data, monetizing it. So, yeah, you know, if it's free, then the lunch is free. You are the lunch argument.
Okay. Right. Yeah.
It's unresolved. People do pay attention to privacy. I don't know if we're really going to see anytime soon legislation in the U.S., but you've already seen, you know, the legislation in Europe, which, by the way, I don't think many people think it works that great, what they've done over in Europe. But there will be more regulation of privacy, I think. And companies are trying to get ahead of it. And one way you can get ahead of it is to move towards a subscription as opposed to an advertising model.
Right. So that would be where I would pay, and that would buy me some kind of security with regard to the privacy issues.
Well, if you're paying $9, $10 a month for something, then the company doesn't need to take your data and sell it to a third party. So that's really how it works. On the other hand, if you're getting it for free, the only way the company can provide the free service is to allow advertisers to reach you, and advertisers will pay more for all kinds of details about you.
So that's sort of the Facebook, Google model, right?
Yes. And what's happened is, in addition to Facebook and Google that know a lot about their users, I mean, just pretty much practically everything about their users, there are a lot of third parties that aggregate stuff behind the scenes. So, for example, if you're on a website, cookie will be dropped on, which is not only accessible to the site you're browsing on, but there's then basically linked up behind the scenes. So you might think, you know, you're looking at a website for the first time that you know that they don't know anything about you and you don't know anything about them, but because of an ad that runs on that website that also ran on another network, actually the website knows everything about you. So there's this whole infrastructure behind the website, behind the actual company, that has aggregated all this data, and that exists. That's already happened.
Well, that is almost scarier to me, because it's one thing if I would say go on Facebook and I say, okay, I'm going to put certain pieces of information on Facebook, you know, pictures, I go to the beach, or, you know, there's a sunset, or go skiing and with some friends, and, you know, over the course of months or whatever. But to have that then turned over to like 50 other companies that are analyzing it on different levels.
That's right. I mean, the good news is that what the companies care about are your buying patterns. So the data that's being aggregated behind the scenes will be things like your purchasing patterns, your demographics, possibly financial information about you. But then again, stuff that's already that if you don't think about it, but you know, your credit card company already knows what your spending limits are and so forth. So it is a little bit, I think it does matter if the data is siloed or if it's aggregated. And the industry has, a lot of companies you've never heard of have aggregated this data and sell it in the advertising world. The good news is it basically stays in the advertising world. So no human being is kind of, staring at your data thinking, that's interesting. It's more like it's just being used to serve up ads. But it sort of does raise concerns about what happens if the data is just kind of out there and what can happen to it. Absolutely raises questions. And that's why I think there is a lot to be said for a subscription model that that doesn't collect all your data and sell it to advertisers.
Yeah, that's interesting. Given the fact that the internet now is so integrated in our life and we use so many different applications, go to so many different websites, we use so many different features that are available essentially for free, not all of them, but to think that the only way to really protect ourselves is to be a subscriber for almost every single one of those. It's like, wow, suddenly this becomes exceedingly expensive, right, to protect.
It does, and it becomes very cumbersome to have these financial relationships with a large number of vendors
who previously
had no relationship with whatsoever. However, they are new services, and frankly, a lot of people will continue to just use the free services in exchange for being marketed to.
Sure, yeah.
Look at the number of people who use Facebook globally. And Facebook is free.
Right.
And they do advertise.
So tell me some of the things that you were thinking about back in the Clinton administration when you were working that and the issues and how they kind of evolved and what you see today as we are kind of moving forward to, I don't even know if it's a Big Brother type of environment or what, but you know, when you see things like what's going on in China with facial recognition by the government and they're tracking everybody all the time in various provinces, or this is what I'm reading, it's a little bit like scary.
Well, the Chinese social credit system collects, so it's kind of like the credit system here in the U.S. on steroids. So here in the U.S., if you miss a payment on your car loan, it's possible that you will pay a higher interest rate the next time you take out a credit card. In China, if you miss your payment, you might not be able to board a train or get on an airplane. So they are tracking, they're starting out with kind of like a traditional credit reporting system, and they've added to it. And obviously, it starts to sound pretty dystopic from a sort of from a U.S. Western point of view. I think that what distinguishes it is the fact that I said earlier that who has the data counts. So if one entity, namely the government in China, has all the data and then links up all these different things, your freedom is curtailed relative to if one merchant knows something about you, but they're the only ones that know something about you. So one thing that we thought about back in the Clinton period, which I think is still important, is that there's sort of a qualitative difference between government and private data. So if the government has the ability to compel you to provide information, and the information that was the government compelled you to give them, for example, to get your driver's license, is then sold, as has happened, by the state that you got your driver's license into the private third-party market, that's kind of, I think that just feels wrong, that you're being compelled by force of law to cough up your information that is then collected by somebody. On the other hand, if you give your information to somebody and then they, without your permission, give it to a bunch of other people, that also feels wrong. And so the solution with respect to the first example is to prevent the government, once it collects your information, from selling it. And the solution to the second problem is that there must be an opt-in process where you specifically say it's okay for you to share my data. So it does, it makes it harder on the individual because you have to pay attention to this stuff. And if you don't pay attention to it, you just opt in to everything, your data will be sort of aggregated. And so a lot of it is like putting in the proper opt-in safeguards and then constraining people from, but not, you know, if you legislatively constrain them from sharing the data, then a lot of the cool things about the technology don't work anymore. So it seems that the best compromise is a system where the customer is voluntarily opts in, and then if they opt in, the data is shared. But if they have reservations about opting in because they don't trust the merchant or whatever, they should have that prerogative. Now, the problem is that as these companies get bigger and develop network effects, it becomes harder and harder to avoid them. So, for example, if you imagine living your life without, I mean, a lot of people have canceled their Facebook or whatever only to sign up for Instagram. I mean, living your life without Google would be rather tough. And because they have so much technology and so, you know, so many network effects. So when you can't escape a private company, it kind of does raise the question of maybe the government should be a little bit more involved in basically enforcing your privacy rights. And that's been the approach in Europe. The problem is it's harder to do that than to, sounds like a good idea, but it's hard to do in practice. So for example, Europe came up with this idea of the right to be forgotten, but it's very hard to actually be forgotten. There's that little warning that pops up every time you go onto a website now, will you accept the cookies?
Right.
It's no easy matter to be forgotten. So
is that just from a technical standpoint, is that the problem they're having in Europe?
As far as the right to be forgotten is, it's not only a technical thing, it's an enforcement thing. Let's say you decide, you know, I don't like the fact that this company has so much information about me. I want them to erase me. And you somehow manage to get through to the company and say, take me out of your computer, out of your hard drives. Mm-hmm. And they say, sure, or you can't reach a person. So let's say it doesn't work. Like, who do you complain to? You kind of need a massive bureaucracy to enforce that. And no such massive bureaucracy exists. And if it did exist, would it be efficient? It's very hard to know. So some companies, if you want to be kind of deleted forever, will do it. But others, you could spend a lot of time trying to do that. And at the end of the day, there'd be nobody to really appeal it to.
So how do you see this evolving? I see this being a bigger problem moving forward, especially in with government.
Well, it is a massive problem. And I think eventually it's going to require people really caring to get laws put in place. Right now, even though it's kind of annoying, you hear about these cases of data breaches and so on, it'd be hard-pressed to find life and death issues involving privacy. And people have been, frankly, rather relaxed about it. So there have been a few congressional hearings. I imagine, if I had to guess, I would say that privacy will continue to be eroded. It's just the nature of the technology. It becomes easier and easier to vacuum up massive amounts of data and store them in the more and more compact form and run artificial intelligence on them and so forth. So it may be kind of like you just kind of like accept it the way when you walk, you know, through a major city, you're videotaped hundreds of times per hour. Mm-hmm. It's just the way it works. It probably, to the extent that there is regulation, it will be where the rubber hits the road, for example, in being denied a loan. And I would say that in many of these cases, there's already regulation so that you can't use a lot of this data that's being collected to decide whether somebody should get a loan. It's illegal. There's a lot of data that could be mined to determine if somebody will repay a loan, which is really what lenders care about. But they're not allowed to do it by law. And the same goes for other things like the cost of insurance. These are heavily regulated. If something is kind of important to people, there's a pretty good chance it's already regulated in the United States. So that protection in some sense already exists. Health insurance, loans, auto loans, so on and so forth. They're already regulated.
People get denied loans all the time because of their credit rating or something like that.
They do. They do. And the credit rating is an incredibly simplistic tool. Interestingly enough, when people are doing things like trying to decide whether to send out an offer for a new credit card and what interest rate and things like that, they're not, the regulations are a little bit looser. And if you talk to people in that space, I mean, some of the things that they have found to be significant predictors about whether somebody will prepay a loan or somebody's a good credit risk are the wackiest things. For example, one of the best indicators somebody told me to determine if something is a valid loan application is how many seconds it takes for the person to fill out the loan application. Because if it's, and not only just the loan application, certain pages of the loan application, because if it's an honest person filling out a loan application, they will spend a certain amount of time filling it out. But if it's somebody who's trying to fraudulently do something fraudulent, they may take like a much longer time on the signature page or something like that. So part of fraud prevention is like mining these like unexpected little pieces of data. But
yeah, that's something you never, or I would never.
So it's kind of thing that
never crossed my mind.
Security field pay attention to. But basic things like getting a car loan or mortgage, it's already pretty regulated, and they're not allowed to use kind of weird things like that to determine your likelihood to repay the loan.
Now, why is that? That's interesting.
Well, you know, because it could be discriminatory, you know. So,
But it makes me think, what about probability statistics? You know, based on certain probability, somebody of a certain age is going to take X amount of time if they're honest, as opposed to somebody younger.
I just described, I guess, would be sort of more of the Wild West of data. But for established things like getting a mortgage or car insurance, there's very specific legislation that has been passed that prescribes exactly what these regulated companies are allowed to consider when they decide what your monthly premium might be, for example, insurance. They're not allowed to use a lot of information because the idea is that everybody's policy is in the direction of everyone's in the same pool, as opposed to, well, your rate will be much less because you live in a certain neighborhood or something like that.
Right.
There are a few things they're allowed to use, like whether you smoke, but not a lot of things they're not allowed to use.
That's so fascinating.
And it's set by politics.
That's set by politics, you think?
Yeah, it's set by politics in the sense that it's, you know, laws passed by legislators.
Right, right. So it makes me think that if these companies are looking at how you use a website to determine buying patterns and not necessarily like credit scores or loans, they can apply these, as you say, sort of wacky angles, how long it takes, you know, to not necessarily lie, but make decisions about certain types of products or some type of activity. Maybe you're doing that with your application too, you know, that kind of thing.
It's amazing. What we do a lot of stuff with words because people describe their tasks as words, and we don't really use this, but you can basically get from certain artificial intelligence APIs. An API is just, you know, you basically send a request to a server and you get something back. So at this point, IBM, Microsoft, Google, all of the large companies have products in Apple in the artificial intelligence space. And from a fairly small amount of text, you can basically get back a report on basically the psychological profile of the person who gave you that text. We don't use that, but it's out there.
Why have you decided not to use it?
It's just not. Wouldn't do anything for us, and I don't think it's necessarily that accurate. But that kind of thing is available.
Oh, that's interesting. So they could kind of break you down and figure out what type of individual basic
For example,
inclinations.
Like, let's say you had a good amount of data. You could look at somebody's social media profile. You could run artificial intelligence on that, and you'd have a pretty good idea of who they were. But actually, you can actually feed it like 5 words, and it'll also respond to you. But of course, the more data you give it, the more accurate it's likely to be.
Sure, sure.
you know, that's one of the interesting things that's happening in technology, but on the with respect to words, but there's all kinds of stuff happening in the visual space, you know, technologies to read video frames, technologies to look at pictures, and it isn't really regulated right now, so people are trying out everything to see what works. Sometimes they're making claims that are not fully substantiated, but certainly there are companies out there marketing facial recognition technologies and, and all kinds of stuff.
So where do you think you're going to go with your application with regard to this?
Well, it's something that's changing so rapidly. It's just getting better every day. So our goal is basically to sort of put some, tweak the current version, come out with a new version in the spring and, you know, just take it from there. Our roadmap also includes releasing an app on the Android operating system as well. We're currently just on Apple, but it's an exciting time to be working on this stuff. There's just so much going on, and there's really so much potential. There's so much untapped potential. Most of the AI that's happened so far is what's called domain-specific AI, and it's just basically pattern. It's, to a large degree, you can say it's pattern recognition. When you feed the models data, they can recognize patterns that might not be that a human being frequently cannot recognize. However, a lot of companies are now, or let's say a certain part of the AI community is working on this whole problem of generalized AI, which is that you're able to transfer knowledge obtained from one data set to another data set, which is kind of the way humans learn. Another interesting thing is that typically most of the AI now is done with large quantities of data, but humans can learn from like one or two things. If you touch something hot and burn yourself, you will remember not to touch anything like that in the future. And so there's still a long way to go. But, you know, if you are someone who's concerned about artificial intelligence, it's basically like an Elon Musk, for example, basically pretty much everything that people asked whether computers could manage to do them, they succeeded. So there's sort of a school of thought that it'll be 100 years before computers are smart as humans on the one hand, but then there's the other school of thought that it's just happening faster than we expected. So yeah, it's exciting any way you look at it.
It's very exciting. It's a little bit scary, you know, certainly, and for people that are thinking, oh my God, these little machines that I'm carrying around have so much power and they're tracked and obtaining
so much data. They're getting better and better. That's the crazy thing. Yeah.
Well, you see, the cameras that are on these phones are astounding. Like because they're as good as a huge Nikon or Olympus camera, but they have the capability in the software to take a, still a very good image and then manipulate it and make it so much better in so many ways, so fast.
Yeah, that's right. And you've probably seen the generalized, the use of GANs networks, adversarial networks to create images. And that's amazing, basically.
No, I don't know that.
This is something that was developed at OpenAI, California. And basically, if you use two deep learning models and you kind of, or networks, and you have them compete against one another, they get smarter faster. If you feed them sort of 10,000 images, they will then, or even less than that, they will then create new images that don't exist in reality, but look completely convincing.
Right.
They'll create like imaginary celebrities that don't actually exist, but look like they're celebrities. So it's, and there's so much going on right now. It's amazing.
Well, I've certainly listened to podcasts about, you know, visual information, people, you know, taking like a speech of Obama and being able to, or Bush or Trump or anybody else, and you can then type the words and they'll manipulate the face and he will say it and it looks exactly like what he's saying.
On the text side, you can also at this point provide a lot of samples of text to a model, and it will basically write phony news stories, it'll write phony speeches, it'll write phony plays in the style of Shakespeare or whomever you want it to do. Just in the last year, it's got considerably better. So it pretty much can fool almost anybody, or it's close to that point.
We'll never know the difference between what's real and what's memorized.
So when people talk about fake news, it's just getting easier and easier to literally have computers generate stories that sound real that are completely fabricated. So it's going to require more discernment and tools, on the other hand, to detect what's real and what's not real. And, you know, that's the thing. It's kind of a spy versus spy thing. It's one side. It's like all of the security. It's like the security stuff. The offense gets better. The defense gets better. And it's just an ongoing competition, if you will.
Oh, Michael, this has been really fascinating. It's been great. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Is there anything else in this vein that would want to bring up?
Yeah, I'd like to ask everybody who's listening to this podcast, go to Boonan.ai or simply go to the App Store and type in Boonan and try out the app. Give it a try and see if you like it. We think it'll help you improve your productivity.
Oh, that's great. Well, I've started using it. Don't use it a lot yet, I must admit, but I'm starting to use it more and more. So
awesome.
We shall see.
Thanks.
We shall see.
Well, great, Chip. Great to have this conversation.
Thank you so much. I greatly appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Thanks for listening today. Do you have an idea for a podcast? Let me know. Visit my website. You can contact me there or send me an email at chip@earthplus30.com. Until next time, this is Chip Spear.